This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Well, finally, at long last, it is official. Britain is no longer part of the European Union. We're taping this a few hours before it happens officially at 11 p.m. tonight in England, but we can get reaction from our British panelist, Richard.
Reaction? Yes, I'm happy. Freedom Day. Tomorrow, we'll wake up for the first time in my lifetime, Britain being an independent country. It is going to... In terms of what actually happens, not a huge amount changes tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. It is still a bit of a drawn-out process. A lot of EU rules and regulations continue to apply from here on out, and they're going to spend the next year negotiating kind of the next step in the separation. But it's nonetheless, it's a very symbolic day. I think we've all seen, or a lot of us would have seen the videos of Nigel Farage giving his final speech in the European Parliament and his triumphal farewell. Getting hectored by schoolmarmish Irish MEP who doesn't approve of flags or criticizing the European Union, lecturing him on what he can and can't say there. A fitting end, I think, to his time in the European Parliament. The flags will come down at 11 o'clock, Britain's flags, where they fly up in all the places where EU member flags fly. No more representation there in Brussels, and so on paper at least it's finished, it's over.
So there are a lot of British people who are celebrating today, Nigel Farage being one of them, but not everybody is happy. There seems to be that school marm that you talked about in the European Commission. There are a lot of those over in Britain as well.
There are. I mean, there's the rather humorous kerfuffle where there's certain people throwing their toys out of the pram about a January 31st commemorative 50 pence coin, and they've been saying, well, we refuse to accept this coin that commemorates Britain coming out of the European Union. All along, there's been this push to portray Brexit as the end of the world. I happened to see a cartoon today that showed London being hit by an earthquake and all these buildings falling down and a couple of MPs saying, oh, that went better than I was expecting. And that's kind of the apocalyptic language that there has been around Brexit. So there's a lot of people that are not happy today. There's a lot of people over at the gravy train in Brussels that are not happy today. You get incredibly generous perks working for the European Union. I think there's several thousand people in Brussels that earn more money than the Prime Minister does.
Wow.
They certainly won't be happy, the British ones that will be coming home from there. You've seen this... no Big Ben bonging for Brexit, no fireworks allowed. Even the BBC, Boris Johnson has a special broadcast to wear tonight, and the BBC are kind of being all curmudgeonly about it. And, well, maybe we won't play this broadcast. We don't have to. You can't make us. I think he announces a tax cut. It's a nice celebratory. I think we should have a tax cut every time we celebrate everything, anything. That would be a great... great celebration, but he's announcing that. But there's a lot of pushback. So there's still, it's a kind of a big final day in that we're leaving the European Union, but a whole lot of those divisions still remain, and they're not going to go away as we wake up tomorrow outside of the European Union.
It is interesting how the United States is saying we are willing to embrace the UK with open arms. We want a trade deal. As Britain is separating from the European Union, you see this dividing line between Anglo-America and Europe. And the way that the Trumpet looks at the world, we talk about Europe being one prophetic block. We talk about Asia. We talk about the King of the South and Iran and an Islamic block. And then we have this Anglo-American block, prophecy puts Britain and the the United States together, and we're seeing this clearer than we have in a couple of generations now.
Absolutely. I think I've seen a few articles over the past few months just charting, you know, we look at it that way. The rest of the world has tended to look at the West and kind of included Europe, Britain, and America all in one block. But I've seen a few articles with people saying, well, actually, maybe that's not quite right. You're having the split in the West, or there's a clear direction from different parts of the West, which, like you said, that's exactly the way that we've been looking at things, that Britain and America are part of these two separate power blocks. And so you see now, you know, Britain being much more supportive of the United States. You see Britain, you know, going all out for these trade deals. They're working with Pompeo and others at the federal level. I saw another article this week talking about how Britain's even working with the state level, you know, going to Texas, going to California, because some of those state economies are so huge that a free trade deal with California is worth as much as a free trade deal with most other countries. So they can push to and then they want to try and get these states to help push at the federal level. So you are seeing a concerted push, and it could well push the two together economically. And certainly you see a much more common outlook in the world, and one that the just high regulation, high tariff kind of outlook that the European Union just doesn't share.
We're going to be talking about the peace deal in Israel. We're also looking at this impeachment circus that's been going on, could possibly wrap up as early as today. And the direction that you see in the United States and the UK and even in Israel, the resurgence that we've talked about happening under the end time Jeroboam within the United States, and how there's the spillover effect into the other nations of Israel. It is really remarkable to see all of this happening all at once. But the fact that Britain is leaving Europe right now, this points right back to this prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about. We've drawn a lot of attention to it. Maybe you can just give the overview of why this is so significant prophetically.
Yeah, this goes all the way back to one of Mr. Armstrong's keynote prophecies, one of the things that he taught, you know, going all the way back to the 1930s from the start of his ministry. And he was talking about the rise of a European power and what the Bible says about a European power, and that you can take the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, and you can take your history books, and they match perfectly together. These books describe a power that has risen in Europe, that's been dominated by the church. It rises and it falls. Revelation 17 talks about this church-led European power rising and falling seven times. You can go through history. You can count how many times it's risen and fallen. And so he could see, well, after World War II, it's going to rise one more time. And another huge keynote prophecy that God revealed through Mr. Armstrong is the identity of Britain and America in Bible prophecy. And that the Bible talks about these nations, that Britain and America are the descendants of ancient Israel in the Bible, along with the Jewish state in the Middle East. The Jews are descended from one tribe, and Britain and America from other tribes. So you've got this prophecy here, and he explained that in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And you put these two trends together, and you see, well, this beast power is something God raises up to correct Israel. This whole beast power even exists because Israel didn't obey God, and God delayed the blessings that he promised to give Israel. And then he rises this power up in these end times to correct Israel. Well, you look at that, and it becomes clear that Britain isn't going to be part of this European beast power. And so he made that forecast just about all along. So right the way from 1945, he started talking about a European Union. Before anyone in Europe was even using the term European Union, saying you're going to see a sort of European Union coming in Europe. In 1956, he wrote, probably Germany will lead and dominate the coming United States of Europe, but Britain will be no part of it. Then you had Britain joining the European Union in 1973, and Mr. Armstrong didn't back away and say, well, okay, we got that wrong. You know, he knew the prophecies, and he knew the Bible was very clear. Britain wouldn't be part of that in the long run. So he said in 1973 that Britain would look back on the day that it's joined as a most tragically historic date, a date fraught with ominous potentialities. And we still see some negative things that Europe's brought into Britain. You know, that division, we're still seeing some of those negative, ominous potentialities play out even beyond Brexit. with that division remaining. But he talked about how it's not going to be good for the UK. And then he talked about 1978. He talked about a union of 10 nations coming out of the common market. And then he said Britain will not be in that empire soon to come. So a really consistent forecast. And as we see that clock bong at 11, or not bong as the case may be, at 11 o'clock tonight, and Britain leave the European Union, I mean, we're seeing Freedom Day and that kind of thing. But really, the most exciting part of what we're about to witness today is Bible prophecy in action, fulfilled prophecy, you know, pointing to the fact that you have a book that contains revelation from God revealed thousands of years ago, and you watch that on your news. It's an event that reveals God's hand in history, God's hand in world affairs, and the Bible is an authority for our lives today. So that's what really makes today just such an exciting and historic moment.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. Go check out the show notes for the program today, and we'll put some resources up there if you want to read more about that and why it's prophetically significant. More big news this week, the unveiling of U.S. President Donald Trump's Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this was a deal that's been in the making for the past 3 years, with the son-in-law to the president taking the lead in this to come up with a plan that can push some type of peace negotiations deal forward between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And we finally, as you said, got some details of this plan. It's a 180-page document, which is the most specific plan ever laid out. It does away with plenty of the myths of the previous attempts to bring peace to the Palestinians and Israelis, those based on the Oslo Accords. That's basically out the window right now, with the United States revealing a favorable plan towards Israel and then giving the Palestinians a path towards statehood, but only if they do change their ways over the next few years. And so the reporting on this is that it has been incredibly favorable towards the Israelis, and indeed it has in many instances, but it doesn't give many Israelis what they want. Many Israelis want all of the West Bank, the entire territory from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River. This plan doesn't do that, at least not for the first few years. It basically says, Israel, you are going to be sovereign over all of Jerusalem. Israel is going to be sovereign over 30% of the West Bank, as it's called right now. That is the territory that Jordan controlled up to 1967. A future Palestinian state would exist in 70% of the West Bank, including the Gaza Strip and some areas in the Sinai Peninsula, but only if they buy in. And that buy-in would mean the dissolution of the Palestinian government in Gaza, which is run by Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They would have to put down their weapons. The Palestinian leadership would have to declare that they accept Israel as a Jewish state next to them. They would have to stop the funding of terrorists, those that have killed Israelis that are now in Israeli prisons. You can't pay them anymore, and a number of other details. But what's interesting about this plan, I think, is that President Trump is very much acknowledging reality on the ground, which is that Israel is the sovereign over Jerusalem. They control all of it right now. And that you have a lot of Israelis living inside the West Bank in these areas, which previous U.S. governments and European nations would have said is going to be part of a Palestinian state in the future. President Trump said, no, those Israeli settlements inside the West Bank, they're going to be Israel. And then those Palestinian settlements inside the West Bank, they're going to be part of the Palestinian state.
The Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas said no, 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 1,000 times no to this deal. If the Palestinians will not accede to the deal, what does this mean?
Well, this is interesting because the Palestinians have 4 years. They have 4 years where Israel has declared that it will not expand the settlements which are inside this area of the future Palestinian state. So Israel's not going to grow them. They're not going to add more population to them. There's going to be a freeze on that, basically a settlement freeze in those areas. And then Palestine or Palestinian leadership is going to have 4 years to come round to those other terms. If not, if that doesn't happen, then this deal for them, they're not going to get a state, at least according to what the United States says. This deal keeps the idea of a Palestinian state alive for 4 more years, which is interesting. It brings us to the close to the end, or 1 year before the end of President Trump's final term. And no one knows what would happen after that. Maybe the United Israel would declare itself sovereign over it all. We'll see. But there is plenty of incentives for the Palestinians to buy into this. They get 70% of the territory that they would want, let's put it that way, in the best possible deal that would be presented to them. And they get $50 billion worth of aid of investment that is going to start them off to developing an infrastructure where they can support themselves. And so while it's being reported everywhere in the world as such a pro-Israeli deal, and it is, I would definitely say it is a pro-Israeli deal because it acknowledges realities on the ground. Israel doesn't have to give up everything that it already has, basically. It still gives the Palestinians a chance for their state. This is a two-state solution if the Palestinians buy in. I think the most difficult thing for the Palestinians to buy into this deal would be they are giving up their chance to be sovereign in East Jerusalem. They want to have the 1967 lines, which puts them in control of the old city, the city of David, the Mount of Olives, all of that. They want as the capital of their future state. The president said, no, it's not going to be. You can have everything that's outside the security barrier, which is further to the east. There's some eastern suburbs of Jerusalem that currently have Palestinians in them. That will be your future state, but it's not going to be East Jerusalem, as we know East Jerusalem today. And I don't think the Palestinian leadership can accept that going forward.
Well, looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, there's nothing in prophecy to suggest that the United States is going to prove to be the savior of the region and swooping in and determining the final outcome of how we're going to bring these two warring parties together. The war between Arab and Jew is there right to the end as far as Bible prophecy goes. And not to mention, there are several other outside forces that have a vested interest in the region. And I'd like to bring in some of our other panelists here as we talk about other reactions to this plan. The United States, as much as Donald Trump would like to be the sole broker of the deal of the century, there are other parties, particularly in Europe, who have other ideas. And it wasn't just Palestinian leaders who weren't excited about this plan. European leaders didn't like it, and especially Catholic bishops. Let's turn to Andrew Miller for this aspect of the story.
Yeah, many Catholic bishops have weighed in on this. There's an organization in the Middle East, the Assembly of Catholic Ordinates for the Holy Land, and they represent actually a variety of different churches, all in communion with the Roman Catholic Church. That includes the Latin Rite Catholic Church, and then also some of the Eastern Orthodox churches that have already come back to Rome. But their reaction to this plan was very similar to Mahmoud Abbas's, where they said the proposed Israel-Palestinian peace plan announced this week is no solution. This is a quote where he says, "This plan will bring no solution, but rather it will create more tensions and probably more violence and more bloodshed." And so that's normally the type of rhetoric you're used to hearing from the Palestinian Authority about saying that, like, well, if you don't give us more, there's going to be more violence and it's going to be your fault. This very very passive aggressive, very passive aggressive way of going about this, saying that the plan, probably for similar reasons as Brent alluded to with the Palestinians, like I said, it doesn't give the Palestinians control over East Jerusalem, and that is going to be a sticking point for the Catholics as well. The Roman Catholic Church they're very pro two-state solution. They want an Israeli state, or at least they say they want an Israeli state, and they want a Palestinian state, but they want Jerusalem itself to be more of like an international city. They definitely don't want it under Jewish control.
Yeah, they've been talking about that for years, an international city.
Right, yeah, for years. You have Jerusalem as an international city where the holy sites, especially the sites that are considered holy to the Catholic religion, are under their control. I'm sure they're probably not thrilled with the borders as President Trump has laid them out as well, because it does give President Trump's plan does give the Israelis control over the Jordan Valley just for security reasons.
And Richard, the response of European leaders to this plan?
Yeah, generally the same as the Catholic Church. The German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas, he criticized the deal, said it had too much involvement for the conflicting parties. Basically, he's saying it's too pro-Israel. And another influential German lawmaker, he criticized it as a unilateral peace plan. The European Council on Foreign Relations, they recommended that Europe reject the U.S. plan in full and take steps to prevent it from becoming a new and dangerous reference point in attempt to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The high representative of the European Union, kind of Europe's equivalent of a foreign minister, he rejected it as well. So what you've got here, I think, is really remarkable, where you've got some of the even these Middle Eastern countries have been relatively open and almost surprisingly so to President Trump's deal. You know, like Bahrain saying that they commend the United States efforts. Qatar was fairly positive about it. Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, both urging Palestinian leaders to accept the plan as a basis for new talks. And then Europe and the Catholic Church are the ones that are kind of giving cover to the Palestinian terrorists and almost excusing any potential bloodshed by saying, well, yeah, of course, this deal is going to lead to more bloodshed. Almost like they're saying, well, it's fine if the Palestinian terrorists go and kill people because they're justified to do so by such a horrible peace plan. So I think it's really remarkable that you've got Europe and the Catholic Church taking a stronger stance against the peace plan than a lot of these Middle Eastern countries taking against it.
So, Brent, when you are looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, obviously this has just happened and we're getting first reactions from all of these different parties. There's the prophecy in Zechariah that talks about how Jerusalem is going to be a burdensome stone to all who try to get involved in it. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I can see this actually blowing over pretty fast, not being any type of violence that is stirred up by it for the near term. Again, everything that this deal does is accept things that are already in effect on the ground. Palestinian lives are not going to change right now for those that are in East Jerusalem. Many of the Israeli Arabs that live in East Jerusalem right now would rather be under Israeli rule in the future anyway, not the rule of the Palestinian state. And so they're not going to be upset over this. And so I think we see, just as with all of other moves by President Trump to acknowledge realities, whether it's Israel's control of the Golan Heights or Jerusalem being Israel's capital or several other things, the world comes out and says that this is against the dogma that we have followed, or the policy that we've followed over the past decades. And so the end of the world is going to result. That hasn't happened in those cases. I can't see it happening right now in these cases. I would say this actually does strengthen Israel further. It's going to show that the United States and Israel are firmly in lockstep under these two prime ministers and presidents. And also with Boris Johnson, he called up the president straight away, day of, Boris, as he was called, on that press conference and said, great job, I like the deal. And again, we have this other trend of the UK splitting itself from European nations. I'd say that this deal is really going to go push to shove in 4 years' time. When we do see, if we get to that point, I think there might be some riots and things like that in the meantime. But the real test is going to be what happens after the Palestinians reject this for 4 years, and the 4 years comes up and Israel is no longer going to be restrained in its construction inside the West Bank. and then we might see Palestinians fear that they're going to lose everything. I won't just say Palestinians. I would say those Europeans get further involved in that point as well.
Right.
Because Europe has always used the Palestinian dream of a state and the Vatican, I would say, as a cloak for their own ambition of control inside Jerusalem, inside the West Bank as well. That's something we've alluded to for a long time. Our editor-in-chief has written an article called The Final Crusade about this future European incursion into Jerusalem against the Jewish state. And, of course, their love for the Palestinians is just a way for them to get in there for this. So I would say for the near term, this is a boon for Israel, and it's going to strengthen the relationship with President Trump in the short term and the United States. But in the long term, it does portend some greater violence. If we just kept to the two-state solution as it existed, we just bumbled along for the next 3 or 4 years, we might see the Palestinians get enraged, but probably not that much. But when they see their hopes for a state fully dissolved because of their leadership's inaction to actually accept a decent deal, as this one is, then they might be pushed further to become more violent. And that's what Bible prophecy does indicate. When they see that their chances for a state, or even if they see Israeli control over Jerusalem, over their holy sites, becoming total and complete, and the groundswell of support for, let's say, their leadership, the Palestinian leadership that does want to maintain control over those sites, if they see that in jeopardy, they will rise up, they will riot. But again, I can see this blowing over for a little bit, but the stakes increasing in the mm-hmm. future.
Well, it is a good idea to just look back at those prophecies that Gerald Fleury has highlighted over the years. They're put together in his booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. The idea that the American president would be able to come in there and essentially through primarily economic incentives encourage or actually convince the Palestinians to give up these long-held goals, which are motivated by factors beyond economics. There are religious factors. There are other things motivating them for sure, and resolve everything by giving them $50 billion, that type of thing. It seems like there's something uniquely American about taking that kind of approach. But the prophecy is clear that in the end, it's not going to be anything like that puts an end to this conflict. It's going to be a European power that swoops in, that essentially deals with it single-handedly and unilaterally and violently, that provokes World War III. It's good to go back and look at the overview that we have in prophecy that is written about very eloquently in that booklet by Gerald Fleury, Jerusalem in Prophecy. We'll also put a link to that article, The Final Crusade, in the show notes for the program today. And we also have an article called The Dark Side of the Pope's Visit to Jerusalem. I think this aspect of the Vatican response to this and the revival of this this idea that Jerusalem should be an international city is quite an interesting aspect to what we see going on here as well. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We will now move over to Asia, where relations between the United States and its longtime close ally, the Philippines, have gotten quite testy. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said on Thursday that he's planning to skip a summit with the United States and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations that's scheduled for March. So Duterte said that he's pulling out of it for strategic and geopolitical reasons. And he said that it's part of his larger plan to, quote, tone down the relations between the Philippines and the United States. Duterte also told his cabinet members not to travel to the U.S. for any reason, saying that he basically, for the time being, won't allow them to visit America. We've kind of seen Duterte often bluster about wanting to sever ties with the U.S. ever since he became the Philippines president back in 2016. That's been kind of a hallmark, really, of his presidency. And this latest flare-up in his anti-American sentiments is because the U.S. Senate has recently passed a resolution seeking sanctions on certain Philippine authorities who took part in aspects of the drug war that the Philippines has been waging. That war has often involved extrajudicial measures and unconstitutional methods of targeting, you know, drug dealers, drug users, even human rights lawyers in some cases. Also, recently, we've seen the detainment of a senator who is critical of Duterte. So the U.S. Senate has been alarmed by the human rights violations that have happened, and it put measures in place to sanction some of those people involved in the unlawful aspects of the drug war. And Duterte is furious about this. He is very upset with the U.S., and he's now planning to skip this security meeting, and he's telling his cabinet to avoid going to America. And this news from this week about Duterte skipping that meeting comes just about a week after he threatened to cancel a decades-old military deal with America that applies to U.S. troops in the Philippines. It's called the Visiting Forces Agreement, or the VFA, and it gives the U.S. jurisdiction over any kind of criminal cases that involve U.S. servicemen. So in the past, we've seen some examples where U.S. servicemen have committed crimes against Filipino citizens, and they've been tried by the American military system, and they've been given what many Filipinos think is essentially a slap on the wrist. So many in the Philippines really despise this VFA agreement. And the agreement is a specific and a fairly limited aspect of the overall relationship, but it could have some significant implications for the entire U.S.-Philippines mutual defense treaty, which obligates both countries to defend each other in the event of attack on either one, and also for the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which permits U.S. to build facilities and locations owned by the Philippine military. So altogether, this could really weaken the relationship there with one of the U.S.'s very valuable allies.
So how do you view this fraying relationship in context of Bible prophecy?
Well, it's interesting that Duterte is not just trying to move his nation away from the U.S., but he's also at the same time pursuing closer relations with China. That's been really another hallmark of his presidency, and it's been evident in the way he's turned to China for more investment into the Philippines. It's been evident in the way he's buying more military equipment from China. And it's also been evident, I think, really significantly in the way that Duterte has decided not to stand up to China in any meaningful way regarding its incursions into the South China Sea. So Duterte is not just eager to create space between the Philippines and the U.S., but he's also eager to simultaneously draw the Philippines closer to China. And that does take on a lot of significance in the context of Bible prophecy, because the scriptures talk about a colossal Asian army that'll be formed in the end time. The book of Revelation says it'll have 200 million soldiers, you know, just an incomprehensibly vast force. And Bible prophecy shows that it'll be a block of Asian nations, so not just one power, not just one country. And prophecy shows that Russia will be the head nation in the bloc, but that China will be in sort of a junior position of leadership. So when we see the Philippines kind of rallying behind China and just pursuing closer relations with China, it is likely laying the foundation for this Kings of the East prophecy to be fulfilled and for the Philippines' 105 million people to contribute in some way to that 200 million man army.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We do have an article called Will America's Asian Allies Pivot to China that will prove valuable. If you want more information about that, we'll put a link to that in our show notes. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Coming up, a French mission to secure the Strait of Hormuz, commemorations for Holocaust Memorial Day, an update on the coronavirus, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We have been tracking increased tension between European nations and Iran. And this is prophetically quite significant. This week, France took a step to push back against Iranian aggressiveness. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
This Thursday, the French announced that they had begun their mission inside the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. A French frigate has started transiting the strait and making sure shipping, both container shipping and also the shipping of oil outside of the Persian, through the Persian Gulf and out the Strait of Hormuz, can continue unabated. Of course, this mission is one that is very similar to the mission that the United States currently has inside the Persian Gulf that was announced in the aftermath of those strikes back in May and July by the Iranians against tankers, both inside and outside the Persian Gulf, when one of the British ships was taken as well. And then we had the subsequent attack of the Saudi oil refinery. There was this increased motivation for nations to protect shipping out of this area. The United States came forward with its mission. The European Union basically said that they didn't want to be a part of it, and Britain wasn't going to be a part of that either. And then back in August, you had Boris Johnson came into power, and he said, I'm done with Europe's mission. I'm going to join the United States mission. And the European nations, led by France, said, well, hey, wait a minute. We want our own mission. We are not going to fall under the leadership of the United States, but we are going to deploy our own ships. And so they have been planning for this mission led by France. It is called European Maritime Awareness Mission in the Strait of Hormuz. And this is guaranteeing, again, freedom of navigation through this strait. And the first French frigate has arrived.
There's been so much discussion in Europe of the need to kind of separate from the structures of NATO and the dependence on the United States. Here's tangible efforts being taken by a major European capital to basically make sure that Europe is looking after its own interests here. Are there other European nations that are looking to contribute to this effort?
Yes, there is eight nations in total that are contributing to it. The Netherlands, they're going to be sending a frigate here in 2 weeks, so there'll be another European vessel there. Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Greece, Italy, and Portugal, along with France and Netherlands, are agreeing to participate in this. So these are all European nations. UK obviously is absent because it's with the United States mission. But I think what's interesting about this as well is because it does fall in line with what the president said, the president of the United States said in his statement after Qasem Soleimani was defeated. He basically said the U.S. is energy independent. We don't need to be here anymore in the Middle East. I'm asking NATO today to step forward and to pick up some of the slack. And he's exactly right. A third of Europe's energy, oil energy needs comes through the Strait of Hormuz out of the Persian Gulf, while the U.S. doesn't really need that oil. And so in a way, you see the United States opening the door for a European intervention. The United States would rather, I'm sure, that the Europeans just jump on board with their mission. But the EU is basically saying here, led by France, that we don't need the United States to lead our mission. In fact, we are separate and we can have our own frigates and our own naval forces down in that region. And so that's only going to get more crowded in the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. They're going to be based in the Emirates. This mission is going to be led or guided from the United Arab Emirates. That's where the European base will be for this. And we'll see how many European vessels come in here. But of course, the Bible talks about, especially in this area, that it is going to be Europe that is the one to confront Iran. While in their statement they didn't mention Iran, we all know that the European forces are there because of Iran's actions in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran doesn't want any foreign forces there. They say it's up to the Persian Gulf nations to go ahead and police this area. Europe is basically saying, no, we don't trust you, Iran, and we don't want to be under the United States umbrella. And so this is very important prophetically, because the Bible in Daniel 11 verse 40 talks about how the king of the south, or radical Islam led by Iran, is going to push at Europe and probably partly over its oil supplies, and how Europe is going to have the ability to come against them with many ships. It from that prophecy, it implies that it's a fast attack and an attack that is very close to Iran, and there are already ships in the region deployed to have that kind of a lightning strike against Iran. And right now we're seeing those European forces, those naval forces of Europe, head down to the Persian Gulf for that.
We have an article at thetrumpet.com we'll put in the show notes from December. The Persian Gulf is about to become dangerously crowded, and that explains more of the prophetic context there. We thank you very much for that, Brent. Monday was Holocaust Memorial Day, this one marking 75 years since the former Nazi death camp of Auschwitz was liberated. And it came with a warning. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this week you had world leaders all gathering together to meet at this, to meet at the entrance of Auschwitz and to give and hear speeches. And I think what they heard there really was a very powerful warning. I mean, this came amidst more and more studies showing that the present generations are becoming more and more ignorant of the Holocaust and of what happened there. Showing, for example, I think there was one showing a significant percentage of millennials in France had never even heard of the Holocaust. You know, not just not knowing much about it or feeling like they didn't know enough about it, but just not even knowing what it was. So with all of these kind of statistics, you had some survivors up there giving some very moving speeches saying, well, no, we can't be ignorant of this history. And some of them were saying, look, I lived through this history. I lived through the 1930s. I saw what led up to Auschwitz. And we are walking down the same path right now. That's what they were saying. Marian Turski, for example, he was a Polish Jewish survivor. And that's one of the things that he kind of built his speech around. He was kind of built it around talking to his grandchildren and that generation. And he went through what he experienced in the 1930s and said, well, it was easy to dismiss some of these things as maybe a small thing. Okay, there's some, the Jews aren't allowed to sit on these benches. Well, that's okay. There's plenty of other benches they can sit on. There's other, it's not that much of a persecution compared to what happened in the past. And then something else happens and something else and something else. And he kind of went through that whole process. And he said, look, we need to be careful. We're just heading down some of the same steps today. He said Auschwitz did not descend from the sky, talking about everything that led up to that. And he told future generations not to be indifferent to some of this history repeating itself. Because if you're indifferent, he said, you will not even notice it when upon your own heads and upon the heads of your descendants, another Auschwitz descends from the sky. And that's just one speaker. And there were several that gave a similar kind of warning.
A pretty chilling warning considering the rise in anti-Semitism in Europe. You wrote about this in an article in the Trumpet print edition recently.
That's right. It was called The One Minority Society Loves to Hate. And it went through some of the statistics, some of the shocking statistics. And then also we had an article on our website just this week called something along the lines of Is It Murder If You Kill a Jew? About a really shocking court case that you saw in France where one of the incidents I mentioned in this article was a couple of years ago when somebody in Paris went and they killed a Jew. And it was, they made clear it was an anti-Semitic attack that they were killing this woman because she was a Jew and they hated Jews. Now, normally, if you commit a crime that's a hate crime, not you, if you of somebody, that comes with extra penalties. You get the penalty for that crime and then some extra because it's motivated by hate or racism. Whereas in this case, the judge ruled that it wasn't murder. He said because the person was on drugs and he wasn't aware that drugs can have a negative effect on your mind, therefore it's not murder. And this led to quite the outcry among France's Jews. The chief rabbi in France wrote to the justice minister saying, well, you're caving into the Islamists and you're basically saying you're declaring open season against Jews. There's a lower bar or you get let off with a much more lenient punishment if you kill a Jew, which is a terrible message to be sending. And you look at the stats and you show massive amount of Jews leaving France, leaving Europe. You see anti-Semitic attacks and hate incidents going about just about every year anywhere in the world. But the main thing I talked about in that article is this rise in anti-Semitism. It's a symptom of something deeper. It's a symptom of major societal problems. But even more than that, it's a symptom of things that are going on in the spirit world, that there's a real devil that hates the Jewish race and Jews because of the connection that they've had to God and to the law and the Bible and to the throne of David and God's rule on the earth, God's plan on the earth. And so when Satan's really having an influence on world events like he was during World War II, you see anti-Semitism increase. And you see the same thing now. It's that the rise in anti-Semitism is a symptom of exactly the same reality today. And that means we're heading to a period of even worse anti-Semitism than you saw in World War II. But then the positive side of that is this is the last period. That's the last time God's going to allow this to happen. And it's all because of a plan that God, Satan has this hatred for the Jews because of just a wonderful, hope-filled plan that God has, that the Jews play a part of, that is for the whole world, that brings happiness and peace to the whole world. And so that article, The One Minority Society Loves to Hate, goes through and goes into all of that.
We'll link to that in the show notes. And also, Is It Murder If You Kill a Jew? That article from this past week. Thank you very much for that, Richard. The coronavirus continues to spread. We talked about it on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour. Go listen to Jeremiah Jacques' report there if you haven't heard it yet. But now for the latest developments, we'll go back to Jeremiah.
Yes, as of this morning, 213 people have been killed by this new pneumonia-like illness being called the Wuhan coronavirus, and almost 10,000 are now infected, including about 9,660 in mainland China. So the vast majority are in China, and all those numbers are considerably higher than when we delivered that report on the Wednesday episode of Trumpet Hour. And the figure for the number of infected is now higher than what the number was for the outbreak of SARS, or severe acute respiratory syndrome, which hit China so hard in the early 2000s. So at that time, SARS became really a global scare. It ended up infecting people in 17 countries. It sickened right around 8,000 people. And by the time it was finally contained in mid-2003, it had killed 774 people. So the new Wuhan virus is a cousin to SARS. They're both in the coronavirus family. And Wuhan hasn't yet killed as many people as SARS, but it has now infected more people than SARS ever did. So Wuhan is still spreading, and this milestone, surpassing the infection numbers for SARS, shows that the threat remains very serious.
Well, I would encourage our listeners to go and listen to that program from Wednesday. Also, Jeremiah has an article called The Wuhan Coronavirus and the Bible's Prophesied Disease Pandemics. You can find that at the front page of thetrumpet.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. And it explains this from a prophetic standpoint and just the Bible's prophecies that there will be pandemics in the end time, whether this particular disease spreads to the point where it really kills a mass scale of people remains to be seen. But we are definitely keeping our eyes closely on it. And thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. The impeachment trial of President Donald Trump has been going full steam this week. And amid all these wranglings in Washington, more revelations continue to emerge regarding the corruption within the government, particularly the residue of the previous presidential administration. For the latest on this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this impeachment hearings and trials and the whole kit and caboodle has been unrolling for months now. Looks like it's coming towards an end. It hasn't revealed anything really about President Trump's alleged corrupt dealings with Russia or Ukraine, but it has revealed quite a bit about the corrupt dealings of the Democratic Party. Last week, President Trump he retweeted a photoshopped image of President Obama like hanging from the top of Trump Tower in his window with binoculars and a listening device. And which apparently irritated a lot of people because there was I think of at least one big article from Vox talking about how these are complete lies and there's absolutely no evidence that the Obama administration spied on the Trump campaign, although apparently Vox has not been keeping up with the impeachment hearings because one of the big developments was the release of the Inspector General's report revealing that not only did the Obama administration spy on the Trump campaign, but it was quite a bit more extensive than had been previously reported. Those media outlets that don't work for Vox had tried to downplay it and just say, that they did spy on Carter Page, but it's just a few emails. But then you're going through this this IG report talking about. It's like, no, they actually sifted through pretty much all emails that Carter Page had sent during the time when he was under surveillance, all the emails he'd sent before he was on surveillance, all the emails he basically sent to anyone inside the Trump campaign or was even carbon copied in inside the Trump campaign. And so, which is something that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, when he wrote the America Under Attack temporarily, I think last year now, was saying that, that warrant to spy on him, it really did open the door to spy on anyone mm-hmm. in the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. He's like that who's always the main target, which now with these FISA reports and these other things that have come out in large part because of the impeachment trial. You can see that that's definitely just verified just the depth of the surveillance mm-hmm. that the Obama administration was using against President Trump and against his campaign and against the Senate Intelligence Committee and the American people in general.
It's quite extraordinary to see how these revelations continue to emerge, that the level of corruption is becoming clearer and clearer, and it points back to what Gerald Fleury has said. He's talked a lot about this, and this week he released his latest article, the cover of the March 2020 Trumpet edition. America has been fundamentally transformed. He's focusing on the scale of the change, the lurch left in the Democrat Party that was really motivated by the previous president, this individual who's behind these very allegations that you're talking about.
Right, because we've had a Democratic Party and a Republican Party since the 1850s, so like 170 years now. And there's definitely been major disagreements between the two parties for all that time. But it was always one basically Democratic or a party that believed in democracy and another party that believed in democracy. But this last election that Mr. Fleury is talking about in these articles is talking about using the nation's spy agencies to rig an election. And so it's not an exaggeration to say at all that this would have been the end of America's constitutional republic if the Obama administration would have gotten a way of use this phony Russian report to spy on the Trump campaign and then use that information to tip the election to the Democratic candidate. That is not how democracy works. It would have been the end of America's democratic republic. And so you're seeing is that the parties are not two liberal democratic parties with different visions for America. It's one party that believes in representative government and another that's looking at just all right deep state authoritarianism.
That's quite an extraordinary thing to come to recognize. I feel like so much of the time when the way the Republicans are trying to work with the Democrats, and we'll see how this goes with whether the impeachment trial actually comes to a close this week, but it seems like they feel like they're working with good faith actors on the other side. The evidence continues to mount that is not the case. And Gerald Fleury's been talking about that we're talking about the very survival of our democratic republic. It sounds alarmist, but when you look at the detail, when you look at what these individuals are trying to accomplish here, just how willing they are to throw out the law in order to fulfill whatever their aims are, you can't argue with it.
Right. If the CIA can make up a fake report to make sure that any political candidate they don't like doesn't get elected, then, like I said, yeah, whoever's the person in charge of this deep state is the dictator of the country. Mm-hmm. It's democracy versus dictatorship. And ironically, the party that's named itself after democracy is the one espousing dictatorship.
But. Yeah. America has been fundamentally transformed. A terrific article, quite a lengthy article from Gerald Fleury in the newest edition of The Trumpet. That is available online. Just go check out that that new edition right there on the right-hand column. Just click on the cover. You've got Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff there on the cover of our new Trumpet. So read that cover story, and thank you very much for bringing that to us, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us any thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Disraeli. Cleanliness and order are not matters of instinct. They're matters of education. And like most great things, you must cultivate a taste for them. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.